MacCast, Sunday, November 9th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode. We've got lots of great stuff to talk about, including getting an update on what Apple is doing with Beats. We found out a few things this week. Also, we've got updated rumors for the iPad Pro, the 12-inch or maybe larger iPad. Also, getting a little bit more info on Apple Watch, some security issues related to iCloud and iOS and some other things. Also, updates to iOS 8 and a whole lot more. Also, we've got a bunch of great feedback from you. And we're going to be doing something really cool this episode. I've had a lot of questions about iOS development and getting into that. And I'm going to talk to some friends of mine a little bit later in this episode about doing exactly that. They left their day jobs, started a company, and we're going to talk to them a little bit about that as well as some of the apps that they develop. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. That is Gazelle. You know, if you're thinking about getting a new iPhone 6 or 6 Plus, and I really recommend it. I love my iPhone 6 Plus. We'll talk a little bit more about that in this episode, too, because a few of you have asked, did I keep that 6 Plus? And yes, I did. But if you're thinking about getting your own and you want some cash to help fund that purchase, Gazelle wants to buy your current iPhone. And what is awesome is it's a great and easy way to get some cash to help fund that upgrade. They give you a fair upfront offer right there on the website. They'll even buy broken devices. So if you've abused your iPhone a little bit, that's okay. Go over to Gazelle and they will still make you an offer. And the process of selling your iPhone to Gazelle couldn't be simpler or more hassle-free. And that's really why I like and use the service. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. And then tell them what you have. iPhone, iPad, even other smartphones and computers. You tell them what you have to sell. You tell them a little bit about the condition, answer a few simple questions. It's a wizard. They make it really easy. And right there, you get a risk-free offer. And they provide free shipping. Plus, in some cases, we'll even send you a box if you'd like. And then you can get, then once you send your device in, you get paid fast. You can get paid by check, by PayPal. They'll even give you an extra 5% on your offer if you choose to get paid by Amazon gift card. And that's the option that I always choose because I'm an Amazon Prime subscriber. The offer process takes less than a minute. So do it today because your gadgets will lose value the longer you wait. So the longer you wait, the more devices they get in, prices fluctuate. So do it now and you can lock in your offer so that you can even get your new iPhone before sending in your old one. So you don't have to worry about that whole transition period. And they, when they get them in, they wipe your devices, they get rid of all your data, and they've handled over 2 million trade-ins at this point. They've paid out over $175 million to customers, and 90% of people using the Gazelle service report having an excellent experience. And I am definitely in that 90%. So what are you waiting for? Find out what your iPhone's worth. Just go to gazelle.com to find out, and a big thank you to Gazelle for their continued support of the MacCast. So right off the bat, let's talk a little bit about Apple and Beats. Apple purchased Beats a while back, and we haven't heard a lot about what Apple is doing with the company. There was a lot of speculation on what they'd be doing, whether they'd be continuing to do the Beats subscription service, what they would be doing on the headphone front. And this week, we got a little bit more information from some of the insiders on the team. Specifically, Billboard did an interview with Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails fame. He was the former creative chief officer for Beats Music and now is an Apple employee. And he said he's deeply involved in a secretive music delivery product in the works at Apple. Not a lot of details were given, as is usual once you're an Apple employee, but he did confirm that the work he was doing is in the realm of streaming music. I almost said streaming music service. He didn't divulge those kinds of specific details, but did say was dealing with streaming music. He also shared his opinion on the fact that he feels the age of paying for music is a, quote, relic of a bygone era, and noted that most younger people these days, kids are growing up in an era where they don't feel they need to pay for music. So there's that changing dynamic. He specifically noted that YouTube is a place where a lot of kids now go willingly to get access to their favorite songs, and they're willing to watch ads in order to be able to do so and not have to pay. And he talked about the fact that more and more people are comfortable with the idea of the cloud and not necessarily owning their music. So this is in direct opposition to what Steve Jobs would always argue, that people wanted to be able to, you know, own their music, have that physical content. He said that physical tie to media and content is really no longer there for the current generation of folks buying and consuming media, things like that. You don't feel like you have to have that CD sitting on your shelf or that movie sitting in your DVD library. That whole process is going away. So sounds like they're getting deeper and deeper into maybe the streaming subscription area, just based on some of those comments. And who knows if they're going to be rolling, you know, Beats technology into iTunes, maybe a new iTunes streaming music service or subscription service that we'd heard rumored about for a long, long time. But a few more details kind of emerging over the past week. And of course, Beats isn't just about the Beats music service. They also do hardware in the form of their Beats headphones. And we got a little hint of what Apple might be bringing next now that they own that part of the business. There was an FCC testing document that appeared that shows a wireless version of the Beats Solo headphones that are in development. Now, earlier this year, under the Beats brand, I think before, just right after Apple announced the purchase of Beats, Beats did launch a new set of Solo 2 wired earphones. These were a cheaper alternative to some of their studio model products. And now it looks like we might get a wireless update to those under Apple's watch. It looks like it's using Bluetooth Low Energy 4.0. There does appear to be a USB mini jack on the side for, I would assume, charging up the headphones. Overall, the design, if you're familiar with the Beats Solo 2 line, they look almost identical, kind of that teardrop, you know, over-the-ear design, but, of course, without wires. And the documents also show that the units are going to carry an Apple brand, at least in the form of Apple being listed as the creator and tester on the new product in the FCC documents, as well as they show a little bit of the packaging where the, you know, symbols and logos for FCC approval and things like that might go. And right in that area, it shows that it's marked with Apple's Cupertino, California address. I didn't see any other Apple logo or branding on any of the images. Those weren't really part of the FCC filing. So it's not clear at this point whether Apple is going to completely continue to brand Beats as its own thing, or whether or not they will sort of merge or throw the Apple logo on it. We're going to have to wait until the update comes. But you know, I think more and more folks want wireless offerings in terms of headphones. You don't want to be tied to wires. You want to be able to have your phone in your pocket or your iPad just sitting maybe in its dock or charger, be able to move around the house while wearing headphones. So looks like that's going to be the next thing on the hardware front. And I'm sure we're going to get a lot more stuff. It'll be interesting to see if Apple starts to pull Beats into the headphones that maybe they bundle with our iOS devices in the future. I think that is likely inevitable to happen. There still is a lot of debate on the quality of the Beats product in terms of audio. Maybe that will improve under Apple's watch as well. We're going to have to wait and see. But that's kind of the latest we're hearing out of the Beats front under Apple's watch. The Japanese blog Mac Atakahara is back this past week with tales of Apple's continued development on the rumored 12-inch iPad Pro. This has been a rumor that's been around for a couple years now. We didn't see it announced at Apple's last iPad announcement. Some were thinking Apple was going to get ready to do that. Others were saying, nope, it's coming later in 2015. Now, these latest reports claim that Apple is specifically designing the device to take on the Microsoft Surface Pro 3, which seems a little bit odd when you first hear it, but Microsoft in their marketing efforts has really been going after Apple, more specifically on the laptop front. So I want to comment on that in a little bit here, but sticking to the latest rumors, they're saying they're bringing some design changes with the 12-inch iPad Pro, the biggest one being that they might be using a smaller 12.2-inch display. Prior rumors, we'd been hearing about a 12.9-inch display, so more in that 13-inch range. As far as looks, the case is said to resemble the current iPad Air 2, just in a larger form factor. They also claim that the design has two additional speakers and a microphone at the top of the iPad. So that could imply that Apple is going to have support for stereo audio in the Pro version of the iPad. They also note that it's not going to be quite as slim as the current iPad Air 2 at 6.1 millimeters, but more in the range of the iPhone 6, 6 Plus thickness at about 6.9 to 7.1 millimeters. So right in that 7 millimeter range. And it is presumed that Apple is looking to launch the MaxiPad. Yes, I did call it that. The larger form of the iPad sometime early in 2015. We really don't have a name for it. A lot of people are calling it the iPad Pro. We've also heard iPad L for large. And I poke fun at it a little bit. Had to, right? It has to be done. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe that was too crass. But anyway, the size of the iPad, interestingly to me, is more closely in line with the rumored 12-inch Retina MacBook Pro. And I think I've said in the past, and a lot of folks think I'm a little bit crazy, I still believe there's a possibility that these two rumors are about the same device. I think they might be intimately tied together. And the fact that this rumor this time around says that Apple's targeting the Microsoft Surface Pro 3 makes me even further believe that Apple is playing around and exploring with merging the iPad and the MacBook Air form factors into a single kind of hybrid style device. And I think what throws people off is that others have tried the hybrid form factor, this sort of idea of a laptop tablet combo, and they've really failed. And I think with the Surface Pro 3 and Microsoft actually gaining a little bit of traction, you know, I think it's getting some good press in certain circles. And the fact that they're targeting the MacBook Air in their marketing, I think this is becoming more and more of a serious sort of play, a serious place that a lot of folks want to go to. You know, they're kind of moving and transitioning from notebooks to tablets, and even Tim Cook kind of believes that. So it makes sense that Apple might want to come out with some sort of design that serves that, what I really think is an emerging space. And something with, you know, I can have a keyboard attached and really do high level work, maybe even combine it with some other kinds of input devices. But then when I want that tablet form factor, maybe I don't have to take all that bulk with me, but I can still sort of have that power. So I think Apple's playing around with this, and I think that product, that sort of fanless 12-inch MacBook Pro that we're hearing about, or Retina MacBook Air that we've been hearing about, and the larger 12-inch iPad Pro, I think it's not that far-fetched that the two might be one and the same. But that's sort of some of the latest rumors there. And, you know, the other thing that we heard this week that I'm not putting a lot of stock in is that the 12-inch iPad development may mean that Apple is looking to move to larger devices and is abandoning some of their smaller ones, specifically the iPad mini. And this one came out of Taiwan's Economic Daily News. They claimed that Apple's planning to cease updating the 7.9-inch iPad mini next year. They say it's because the focus is moving to larger devices, and the fact that the iPhone 6, and more specifically the 6 Plus, and larger form factor phones are kind of eating into that smaller tablet market share. And they also pointed to the fact that Apple didn't do a lot of updates with the latest iPad mini 3 revision as kind of evidence that Apple is moving away from that form factor. Again, I really think this is highly unlikely. I think we're going to continue to see iPad mini development. I don't think we're going to see a lot of strides and big technology changes moving forward in the line, because I think it kind of fits its space, it serves its market, and it's a maturing product. And this is, we talk about this a lot. As Apple's products mature, the sort of innovation and, you know, the big leaps forward in terms of technology, those don't really happen. What you fall into is you get minor incremental upgrades and improvements. So I think we'll continue to see screen improvements, battery improvements, processor improvements, all those sorts of things. But the overall form factor and the you know, main core features are not going to change all that much moving forward. And Apple's going to focus on newer products and newer designs and things. And I think that's only natural. So I think that's what's going on with that. Now, speaking of newer products and radical designed form factors, Apple is getting closer to the Apple Watch launch, and a lot of us are watching that really closely. We want to know when we can get one of those things on our wrist. To date, Apple has not given a specific release time. They, at the event, only said it was going to be early 2015. Well, this past week, Apple's Senior Vice President of Retail and Online Stores, Angela Arendts, sent out a video message to retail employees, and it gave a little bit more specific date for the release of the Apple Watch. She said in that video and in the note to her team that, quote, we have a new watch launch coming in the spring. So it's looking like it's not going to be that earlier part of 2015. So you can kind of rule out maybe January, February, March timeframe. It's probably going to be a little bit later, more in the springtime. It doesn't give us a lot to go on, but I've always believed that when Apple says early 2015, they mean the tail end of early 2015. So I've always been thinking May timeframe, maybe a little bit earlier. In that video, she also does reveal a little bit about what the retail buying experience will be like at Apple stores once the product has hit the market and is launched. It notes that employees are going to get some training on how to introduce customers to the new Apple Watch, and that customers are going to be allowed to try on different styles and sizes in the store. I would hope that also means that they're going to have the different band offerings available so you can try out all the different combinations and things like that at an Apple retail store. I think buying an Apple Watch is going to be a little bit trickier decision for consumers because there are so many options and price points and things like that. So, pre-orders, it's going to be interesting to see how those go. I'm not sure I want to pre-order an Apple Watch because of all the different materials. You can have the stainless steel case or the aluminum case or the different kinds of bands. Do you want leather or do you want the more sporty polymer style band, or do you want, higher end metal offerings like the Milanese Loop and things? It's going to be a little bit of a tricky decision, but at launch, it sounds like there's going to be a big focus on promoting the Apple Watch at retail locations, and hopefully we'll all be able to go in and kind of experience it for ourselves before we make that final purchasing decision. Another thing that a lot of us have been wondering about is what is the pricing going to be? To date, Apple has only said the pricing is going to start at US$349, and it's been pretty much revealed that that is going to be for the Sport Edition watch, the one that has the aluminum case and the Ion X and not Sapphire lens cover. Now, this week, French site iGen says that they have unnamed sources that say the Apple Watch in the other editions, specifically the Apple Watch edition, the one that is going to be the stainless steel model with the sapphire glass, that's going to be priced starting at $500. And if you want to move up to the top end gold edition versions, you're going to be looking at $4,000 or $5,000. Now, a lot of folks think that that is much higher than the price that was being thrown around by some jewelry analysts. They said the edition was going to be as low as $1,200, and I say as low as a little tongue-in-cheek. I mean, that's pricey for a bit of technology, but I guess in the realm of the jewelry and the watch world, that's actually a pretty low price point. Most other reports, though, seem to be indicating that the gold edition would be much higher, more in that $4,000, $5,000. I had even seen, and I think John Gruber published, a $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 range. So if you were thinking that was going to be the price, you might feel that $5,000 is actually a bargain. But just an extreme range, again, of watch pricing, depending upon the different materials and combinations. I was really hoping to get the Apple Watch Edition, the stainless steel model, but I think at $500, that might be a little bit pricey for at least the first generation of a product. I mean, a lot of us really don't know, is the Apple Watch, is a wearable, a smartwatch, something that is going to fit into our daily lives and make a lot of sense? If anybody has the ability to prove that to us, I think it's going to be Apple, and I'm probably most excited about the Apple Watch. And I've had a Pebble, and a lot of you know that, and I enjoyed using that, but there wasn't enough game-changing things, life-changing things, I think, in that to get me to continue to wear it. And specifically, the whole process of sort of charging the device and using a proprietary cable, those sorts of things. Just the day-to-day usage experience fell a little bit flat for me. So hopefully Apple can address some of those concerns, make it a compelling enough product. I think Tim Cook did come out and say pretty much that we know it's going to have about a day's battery life. It's going to be a daily recharging device. But hopefully there'll be enough solutions, stands and things with the inductive charging that make it easy enough. I can just set it on my nightstand at night. I am the type of person who, you know, when I do wear a watch, I don't wear it in the evening. So if I have an easy way to take it off and just maybe set it down next to me on my bedside table and it charges and I can pick it up in the morning, that may work. I think the problem with the Pebble was it had this, you know, really funky proprietary MagSafe-like connector, and I would misplace the cable. A lot of times it didn't stick very well, so if I wasn't careful about how I set it down and it would sort of bump off at an odd angle, I'd wake up and the watch wouldn't be charged. So those sorts of things are going to need to be addressed. But I am very excited about the Apple Watch. Unfortunately, it sounds like we're not going to see it till later in early 2015. But again, I think it's going to make a huge impact, and Apple will certainly sell a lot of them. It sounds like they're going to make some money at those price points as well. We need to talk about this week security and the media and hype, and how a lot of times stories will pop up in our community surrounding security, surrounding Apple, and they will get blown completely out of proportion and put a lot of us into a panic. And that happened to me a few times this week. So there's a few stories we need to talk about related to this. The first one came about related to iCloud, and specifically documents in the cloud or iCloud documents. And it was set up because some security researchers called foul on something that was going on with Apple's iCloud services. Even though they had chosen or were making the conscious choice, I guess I should say, not to store their documents on iCloud, what was happening was they saw that documents were still being saved into iCloud. Now, to be clear, they had iCloud documents turned on, and they believed this was some sort of new issue related to OS X Yosemite and the new iCloud documents feature. But Ars Technica wrote a little piece over on Infinite Loop, and they pointed out that Apple has had a support document in the works or around for a while. And I will point to that in the show notes at machest.com that explained exactly what was happening with documents as they relate to iCloud. And so what might have changed in OS X Yosemite is that third-party applications that have chosen to enable support for Apple's iCloud documents, they're now exhibiting the same behavior that some of Apple's default applications had in terms of adding documents to iCloud. And so what's happening here, just to kind of clarify things, is what they discovered was that when they were opening up applications that supported the iCloud documents feature and creating a new document, it was auto-saving their changes right into iCloud. So if you haven't specifically saved the document and said, I want to save it locally on my Mac, the default autosave behavior with documents in the cloud under Apple's apps, and now I guess iCloud documents, is to actually save that to iCloud. And that's so when you go over to the same application supporting documents in the cloud or the iCloud document service on your iOS devices, you'll find those there and you can sort of pick up where you left off. That's the whole concept behind continuity, things like that. So sort of the circumstances when documents are auto-saved to iCloud that are detailed in this Apple support article are documents created with iWorks applications, specifically Pages, Numbers, or Keynote for iOS, on the Mac or in iCloud.com, and also with Apple's applications like Preview and Text Edit, those are automatically saved to the iCloud under these certain circumstances. And that is when you first create the document and start editing it without actually physically doing a save, it will auto-save into iCloud. Also, periodically, it's going to auto-save as you continue to edit the document. And again, if you haven't specified, I want to save this document locally on my Mac, those auto-saves are going to get saved up into iCloud documents. And then on your iOS devices and on iCloud.com, the document is auto-saved when you close the document or close the app. And I think this also happens on the Mac now, too, with the autosave feature. If you open up an application and you start working on a new document, and then you simply close the app, right? When you come back to the app, it will open up, and that document will be there again available for you to edit. And that's what this the first security researcher that noticed this behavior was specifically doing. He was using, I think, TextEdit as sort of a sticky notes application to quickly fire up a TextEdit document, make some changes to it, you know, just an untitled, unsaved document, add some information into it, and then quickly quit the application without specifically saving it to his Mac. And he noticed, oh, it's actually going out to iCloud and saving my document in iCloud. And he was putting in password information and other information that he did not want stored on Apple's servers up in there, and had not realized that it wasn't auto-saving locally, which I guess prior to maybe Mountain Lion was what was happening. Again, all these changes seemed to come about when Apple released the whole documents in the cloud feature. And once again, he started doing some more research and found that third-party applications were exhibiting this behavior also in OS X Yosemite. So it may be, again, that now that we have iCloud documents and the iCloud documents library, that this is sort of the default behavior. So the only way to completely stop this behavior is to, one, open up a, you know, start a new document in one of these applications and then immediately do a save. Don't add any information to the document, but immediately save it and then pick a local file location on your Mac to actually save the file. Then any auto saves in the future are going to go to that location and not up into iCloud.com. You could also go in and completely disable documents in the cloud or iCloud documents in the iCloud system preferences, but then you wouldn't get all of the advantages of that. And then since this story came out and people have been poking around, it was actually discovered that there is a hidden terminal preference, and I will put that command in the show notes at maccast.com, so you could do one of those default write commands and actually turn off the save new documents to iCloud feature. There's a little terminal command you can put in there, and then it won't do this behavior anymore. I don't know what that means in terms of saving, if it will then default to saving locally. I think what will happen is it just won't autosave. So you're going to have to do that first new document save manually before it starts autosaving to any kind of location. But you know, this sort of freaked everybody out and was like a big news story, but it really isn't anything new. It is something, though, a lot of us probably weren't aware of. I was not aware that new created documents in applications that support iCloud documents or documents in the cloud were actually auto-saving up into iCloud. And that is the normal behavior, something Apple has done for our convenience. So I guess at the very least, it's good that this came to the forefront and was brought to everybody's attention. But I think the panic that was created, you know, that Apple was doing something deliberately malicious, or that Apple was trying to do something that makes our documents and files insecure, that they're trying to steal our data or our information, something like that. Yeah, that's not really what's going on here. But it certainly is something that we should be aware of, a feature we should know about, and maybe Apple could be a little bit more transparent about it. They also could make that setting, that sort of default setting, exposed to users so that you can make a choice one way or the other whether or not you want those new documents to be saved up into iCloud. And I think Glenn Fleischman wrote a piece for Macworld kind of talking about that. And I agree with that sentiment. There should be a setting in the system preferences or in the iCloud preferences to make this more clear to end users. But I also don't want to go to the other extreme where every time you create a new document, you get a dialogue or something like that that pops up and says, hey, this is going to save into iCloud. I think that's going a bit too far in the other direction. But just wanted to point that out. Another thing that I wanted to talk about was the fact that with regard to iCloud and documents in the cloud, is that there was a story out this week that Apple's expanded their iCloud efforts over into Microsoft's turf, specifically into their neighborhood. Last month, I guess Apple acquired a cloud networking startup called Union Bay Networks, and they now have reportedly 30 employees working out of a Seattle-based office. Union Bay Networks was a stealth startup focused on enabling next-generation networking for cloud computing and software-defined data centers, according to their website. It's not really clear exactly what Apple purchased the company for, and of course, Apple doesn't comment on that, but They do have some job postings up that are for positions at the Seattle office, and it seems to indicate that it is a hub for some of Apple's future iCloud and development projects surrounding both iCloud and the iTunes store. So it'll be interesting to watch and see what Apple is doing up there in the Great Northwest. Getting back to some of the other security scares that happened this week, we heard about something called RootPipe, which was a hack discovered by a Swedish security firm, TrueSec, and it is an unpatched vulnerability that affects macOS 10.10 Yosemite and actually goes all the way back to OS 10.8.5. And what it is it's a bug that allows an attacker to gain root privilege escalation without an admin password, potentially giving them full access to your operating system. Now, the firm has notified Apple of the RootPipe exploit and has agreed not to disclose any details of the exploit until Apple can actually have time to issue a patch for the vulnerability. But once again, when this story surfaced, the media kind of went crazy and made it sound like, oh, we're all vulnerable, this is on all of our systems, really bad things are going to happen. And then, as often does, slowly other more, I think, responsible journalists started looking into this, started to try and find out some more details and dig a little bit deeper, and discovered, yes, this is a serious, you know, potentially harmful zero-day exploit, and Apple needs to patch it, but Apple is working on it. A lot of the details are not in the wild. This was recently discovered, and so we don't know that there's any in-the-wild attacks taking advantage of this. But then there were also specific details that seemed to indicate, you know, a lot of us probably aren't vulnerable, and also that there are some easy steps you can take to protect yourself. So the RootPipe exploit specifically has to be executed on your Mac using an account with admin privileges. Now, a lot of us, if you've just set up your Mac with a single user account, that default account is an admin account. And we've talked about this on the MacCast in the past. One recommendation is don't run your main user account as the admin account. Set up the admin account and then go into System Preferences and set up a separate user account that you use as your daily account. And then when you need to do things with heightened privileges, you can just switch over and log into that admin account. Also, under your standard user account, if you're running a software installer or something that does need heightened privileges, it will actually prompt you for the admin username and password, and you can just temporarily escalate up and get the privileges you need to do whatever you need to do. And that keeps your system more safe and secure. For those of you who are in the know, it's, you know, what's called a sudo, or sort of, you know, leveling up your permissions at the Unix level under the hood. So if you're in terminal and you're issuing a sudo command, it's the same sort of thing. The problem with the RootPipe exploit is it kind of allows you to get sudo privileges without having to enter that admin username and password. So the first thing that needs to happen is you need to be running in that administrator account. The other thing is that an attacker, in order to take advantage of the exploit, would also need physical access to your Mac, or they would somehow need remote access. So they'd have to do some other hack to get remote access to your system or physical access to your system. That could maybe be through a Trojan horse application that was installed at some point. But again, you'd already have to be exposed and vulnerable. And if you were already exposed and vulnerable, you already have a security problem on your Mac. So again, don't run admin as your main account, and if you don't install apps from unknown sources or shady websites, do all the things that we've talked about in terms of protecting your security, you're likely going to be okay till Apple is actually going to put out the security patch. So you're not going to have to be panicked or worried about that. And then the final security alert that came out this week, this one surrounding iOS, was something called WireLurker. It was a malware that surfaced for the iPhone this week in China, and it uses a Trojan horse, which is mostly found in pirated apps, to infect your devices. And I guess it takes advantage of a hole or a security issue in Apple's own enterprise provisioning tools to help push its payload onto infected or affected iOS devices connected to your Mac via USB. So once again, there was a lot of panic, a lot of people saying, oh, iOS apps are potentially exposed and exploited. This didn't require any kind of jailbreaking. So a lot of times to get infected by malware via pirated apps, you'd have to be, you know, running a jailbreak and going to some of those websites that are a little more shady. But this one actually was able to do that without a jailbreak, but still had to go through Apple's enterprise provisioning tools. So these would be tools you'd be using to directly, I would assume, install those pirated apps from some of these websites that are around in China and stuff like that. And Apple jumped on this really quickly. They used their gatekeeper feature in OS X to block a lot of the apps, these pirated apps that were carrying this Trojan horse. But they are ultimately going to have to update their provisioning tools to patch against the exploit. And so some security folks were saying, well, Apple's not doing enough, just, you know, flipping on the gatekeeper feature. But once again, if you're not downloading pirated apps and trying to install those onto your iOS devices, you're likely not going to be infected by the Trojan. So your potential risk is, you know, minimized. There's also been some exploits where different Trojans and things could be potentially deployed through USB. There was a USB exploit that surfaced. So another thing you probably don't want to do, and I got this information from Jeff Gamet, wrote a piece over on the Mac Observer, you know, you don't want to connect your iOS device via USB to an untrusted computer. Make sure you're, you know, plugging it into your computers and not, you know, some random computer at a computer lab or something like that. The other thing is you don't want to use chargers from people you don't know to power up your iOS device's battery, because all of those things connecting with a physical USB cable can maybe open you up to some of these more recent exploits and things like that. But again, if you make smart choices, you don't do kind of shady things, you continue to patch your operating systems when Apple issues their patches, most of us are going to be protected pretty well against these sorts of exploits. I don't want to say 100%, you know, because there could be an app that slips through Apple's review process and has one of these Trojans in it. But, you know, we are pretty well minimized against these sorts of exploits if we kind of play within Apple's sandbox. And I think that's the thing to remember when you see these stories pop up. Make sure that you wait a little bit, a few hours even, we start to get more information. There's all these usually reactionary stories that pop right up with sensational headlines to drive traffic. Get past those. Get to the folks who are a little bit deeper and go a little bit deeper into these sorts of things. Mac Observer is a great source for that. They wait a little bit. Tidbits does a really good job. Ars Technica is another place that I like to kind of watch to see about these stories and exploits. There's a lot of good sources that are going to dig in and dig a little deeper and kind of take and diffuse the panic a little bit. So make sure that you're getting all the information you have before you worry too much about this stuff. I'm not saying we don't have to be aware of it and watch for it, but let's not get crazy. And kind of speaking of patches and updates, Apple is prepping an update for iOS 8.1. 8.1.1 is out to developers. You know that iOS 8 kind of had a rough and rocky technical start. I think 8.1, the 8.1 update, seems to have smoothed out a lot of the rough edges, but certainly not all of them. Some users are still complaining about crashes and Wi-Fi and Bluetooth issues. I know, I think I had been having a lot of, you know, back to the white Apple logo crashes on my iPhone 6 Plus, but those have seemed to have calmed down since the 8.1 update. But the good news is that for any of you who are still having lingering issues, Apple has 8.1.1 out in beta to developers this week. It reportedly addresses a number of bug fixes along with offering some stability and performance improvements. And for those of you on older devices, you'll be very much looking forward to 8.1 because it's being 8.1.1 rather, because it's being reported that older devices like the iPad 2 and the iPhone 4S are seeing much better performance with this latest version of the beta. And I know that had been an issue for some of the older devices, that they seemed a little bit sluggish and slow. Real quickly, I want to comment because a few of you have asked. I guess I never officially announced what my decision was on whether or not I was going to keep my iPhone 6 Plus. I did decide to keep that device mainly because I like the larger screen real estate. I also am hoping to see developers push out a lot of custom user interfaces that take advantage of specifically the iPhone screen real estate on the 6 Plus in portrait mode. I think there's going to be a lot of creative things. It's going to take developers a little while to figure those out. I haven't seen a lot of that yet, and that is getting a little bit frustrating to me, because there have been some significant app updates, specifically for things like my RSS readers, and I haven't seen anybody really taking advantage of the 6 Plus and the extra room, but I'm still hopeful that that might happen. But I did decide to keep it. Now, I will say another thing that happened this week is there is an issue that may not be addressed by the software update 8.1.1, where some users, specifically of larger iPhones, the 6 and the 6 Plus in terms of storage size, so the 128 gigabyte models, they're reporting that they're getting random crashes and restarts, and worse, there are limited reports of a situation where the device will crash and get stuck in a boot loop following restart. So it'll just keep restarting itself over and over again. And this is supposedly happening on, again, the 120 gigabyte units. And specifically, it's being said those units that people have thousands of apps installed. So if you have 500, 600, 700, or a few thousand apps installed on your device, it seems like you're more likely to run into this particular bug. Now, the Business Korea website floated the theory that this could be because Apple changed their NAND flash modules to triple level cell modules in the new iPhones. I guess previous devices had been using what's called multi-level cell flash, and there have been reported issues on Android with the controllers and the flash, the triple level cell flash technology. The report claims that Apple could be facing a potential huge recall, but I think this is unlikely. I kind of been digging into the story a little bit, and the kind of genesis for it is a discussion thread on Apple's website that shows a few hundred people, 157, 200 or so people reporting this sort of looping reboot issue with their iPhone 6 and 6 Plus devices. And while it may be a hardware issue, my guess is it's limited to a small batch or a relatively small number of units, and that it's just a bad batch of flash that may be causing it, or maybe some other sort of hardware issue. I don't think we can specifically point to this triple level cell technology. There have been reports that Apple is quickly replacing the triple level cell chips with the multi-level cell chips in iPhone 6 and 6 Plus's 128 gigabyte models that they're producing now, and that they've sort of changed the supply chain, or made changes in the supply chain rather, to move back to the other chips. And I guess that's supposed to resolve the issue. But I really think if you've been impacted by this, you probably just want to first try doing a restore of the operating system via iTunes. So, you know, completely erase and restore the OS and then restore from backup. If that doesn't work, you may go so far as to do a restore and setup as new. Not one of my favorite things to do, but can resolve issues if you're having, you know, continuous things like apps crashing, or more specifically, complete springboard crashes where you see that white Apple logo. But if none of those things work for you, I would get to a Genius Bar or contact Apple to see about a replacement of your iPhone. I mean, Apple makes tens of millions of these devices, and they all go out into the market all at once. I think it's very much conceivable that you could have a small batch of components that maybe have a hardware issue. And Apple is typically very good about identifying those, and then they simply offer up replacement models. And we've already seen some reports of some folks who have had this issue that have taken their devices to Apple. Apple has replaced them, and that has resolved the problem. So whether it's a larger, bigger known issue, something related to the NAND flash, we'll probably never know. But I'm thinking it's more just, you know, a small batch of modules or memory that was bad, and Apple's just going to have to replace devices on a case-by-case basis. But they're not going to know about it unless you actually notify them. So just sort of complaining and posting on blogs and things like that isn't really going to help you in the long run. If you continue to have issues, you're probably going to want to contact Apple. And I'm monitoring my iPhone 6 Plus because I do have a 128 gigabyte model, and I have had those, you know, white Apple logo crashing issues more frequently than I have on any other iPhone that I've owned. So I'm watching it closely. Like I said, it seems like the 8.1 update has resolved a lot of those issues for me. So I may not have, you know, the lingering larger hardware problem. But if it continues to happen, my plan is to take my phone to a Genius Bar and see what they say. And that's what I'd advise you to do as well. And then the last thing in the news for this week is some pretty positive numbers for Apple in both the iPhone space and in the Mac space. Let's start with iPhones. Canaccord Genuity has issued a note to its investors indicating that Apple now enjoys a 86% share of all handset industry profits. That is huge. It's one of the bigger industry share profits that profit shares that I've heard from Apple in a while. It's up considerably, and the gain likely came at the expense of Samsung. They noted in the report that Samsung's industry profit share for the smartphone industry came in at 18%, and that's the lowest number Samsung has seen since 2011. Now, math buffs, if you're paying attention, you've noted that 86% and 18% are actually 104% of the industry profits shared by Apple and Samsung. And the reason that's possible is that some of the competitors actually have negative shares. So, for example, Motorola has minus 2% of the industry profits, while Microsoft has minus 4%. As far as the other manufacturers go, LG had the other positive part of industry profits. They are at 2% of industry profits, and both HTC and BlackBerry broke even at zero. So if you add all of those up, what you have is about 100%, 106% profit share, and that is shared exclusively by Apple, Samsung, and LG, which was very interesting. But Apple doing very well. So even though they're selling not the majority of handsets out there, they are still gaining the lion's share of the profit. So we know that Apple makes money on their devices. It's actually a complaint levied against Apple saying that, you know, their profit margins are too high. They should give their consumers a little bit better deal. But I think the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus sales numbers show that Apple's doing the right thing. And if you take a look at their stock price, which is at an all-time high right now, I think it closed at about 109 or so this week. I think Apple is making all the right moves and doing the right things in the market. And I think they're probably very happy with both sales and profits. And same thing on the Mac front. IDC noted that Apple now has a 13.4% share of the U.S. PC market. That moves them up a position, puts them in the number three place behind HP, which is at 27.7%. So Apple considerably behind in terms of the percentage, but moving up. And globally, Apple took the number five slot, raising its market share by 5.7% year over year in Mac sales. And if you remember, Apple just announced a record-breaking quarter for Mac sales, selling 5.5 million units for the last quarter. So I think the halo effect is working very well for Apple. I think a lot of consumers are getting in with iPhone and iPad, and I think ultimately that's resulting in more Mac sales. A lot of folks had been worried that, you know, PC sales and desktop sales, notebook sales would be slowing because of tablet sales. The iPads are doing okay. We've seen iPad sales actually declining a little bit year over year if you paid attention to the last quarter numbers, but still selling a large number of units. And I think that translates into more Mac sales for Apple, more people coming into our Apple community. And I think that's just great, you know, just growing the community. I don't think we've ever thought we had to have the largest share or the largest numbers. But what I've always felt is we enjoy the largest quality of users. And I think a lot of people who kind of get frustrated and fed up with their technology on other platforms, they find their way to the Apple community. And we have such a great community that supports each other and kind of helps each other out that they get hooked. You know, you get pulled in. And some people call that a cult. I don't really think it's a cult. I think it's a community banding together. And it's just a nice feeling. You get a great sense of satisfaction when you use these devices. And yeah, we might pay a little bit more and Apple might benefit a little bit more from us paying a little bit more. But I think ultimately we all kind of win out in the end because we have great things like the MacCast in this community and all the other podcasts that are surrounding Mac and the forums and your local user groups. It's just a really fun place to hang out and be. And it's why I continue to do this show and have such a great time doing it. But some great numbers for Apple this week. And I think, you know, 2015 is looking pretty bright. We've got great new products on the horizon, like the Apple Watch. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what Apple has for us in 2015. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Lynda.com. You know, Lynda.com is a place where you can go to continue to learn, keep up to date with your software. You can pick up brand new skills or even explore hobbies by following their great video tutorials. They have over 3,000 courses that are taught by industry experts, and they're constantly adding new courses each and every week. And what I love about Lynda.com is just the quality. This is great production value stuff. You get great audio, great video, screencasts that you can actually see. So many places you go, you'll find it's hard to follow along. Maybe the audio is not that great. You get consistent, great quality with Lynda, and their courses cover all skill levels. That's another thing that I really like, is whether you're an advanced user and you want to expand your skills, or you're just starting out with a new topic, they have a way to for you to get into it. And everything's divided up into easily digestible chunks. You can do a whole course all at once if you have several hours to spend. If you want to just grab a little bit for a few minutes, they work that way as well. And I mentioned in this episode, we're going to be talking to some developers about getting started with iOS development. Well, one way to do it is Lynda.com. It's a great place to go to get started and to expand your skills. As a matter of fact, I did a quick search this week and I found a course on building a note-taking app in iOS 8 from scratch. So they show you the entire process to get up and running building your own note-taking app, or they even have a course on iOS game development using SpriteKit, which is one of the new technologies that Apple has available for game development. You can use SpriteKit for a bunch of other things, so you can dive in there and get up to speed, expand your iOS development skills, or, you know, start completely from scratch. So you really should check it out. They also have a mobile application for Apple and Android devices, so you can learn anytime, anywhere, which makes it really convenient. And their premium plans also let you download project files so that you can practice along with the instructor. And they have all of this starting for one low monthly price of $25. That gives you unlimited access to the entire Lynda.com library. And you can also gift subscriptions to Lynda.com. So this is perfect. We've got the holidays coming up, and they're coming up faster than you think. If you have someone in your life you think would benefit from really great training and online video tutorials, give them a Lynda.com subscription. And MacCast listeners, you can try everything for free. You can get access to the entire course library for a week just by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast to try it out. If you haven't done so, take a quick moment, pop over there, give it a try. I think you're really going to love it. You'll get hooked. And it's great service. And a big thank you to lynda.com for their continued support of the MacCast. I mentioned earlier that I've been kind of having these random app crashing bugs and OS crashing stuff going on with my iPhone 6 Plus, and I haven't been really able to figure out why or get to any sort of common threads about, you know, what am I specifically doing that's causing this crash. It can be a little bit tricky because we don't have things like the console log or the activity monitor on our iOS devices to kind of troubleshoot and figure out what exactly is going on. So all we can kind of say is, hey, I upgraded to this operating system and now I'm having these issues. But I had sort of just been taking the tact of, oh, well, that was weird. It crashed, forgetting about it and moving on, maybe occasionally doing a hard reboot of my device to kind of clear things up. But recently I was emailing back and forth with Greg, and he was able to pinpoint one of the crashes that I had been having. So I wanted to share my findings with you in case you've also noticed this crash. It's something that is certainly reproducible, and it has to do with the camera roll. Specifically, it kind of cropped up with the camera roll library. So with the latest update, 8.1, Apple did bring the camera roll back. Now, I've gone on to find out that this bug seems to surface even if you're in another album. And kind of one of the trigger things seems to be if you're in an album that has several hundred photos in it. And what Greg noticed was that when he was accessing albums in the Photos app on his iOS device and scrolling, the scrolling would be smooth in portrait mode, but if he entered the album in landscape mode, it would start to kind of get glitchy and it would stutter and pause and stop at different points. Now, I don't know if this only impacts the iPhone 6 or 6 Plus or if it's any iPhone running iOS 8. I think Greg and I are both running either a 6 or a 6 Plus. But the way you can reproduce this is, again, open up the Photos app and then put your phone into landscape mode and access an album, something that has several hundred photos. I was using a library that had about 500 to 900 photos in it, any one of those albums. And the first thing you'll notice is that the image thumbnails are slightly larger when you're in the portrait mode. And then when you start scrolling, you'll start to occasionally get, especially if you're scrolling quickly, get these little stutters and hangs. And some of them might be really brief. They might last a little bit longer. But if you keep scrolling back and forth, eventually what'll happen is the app will crash. You'll just be back to the app launcher. And so it's definitely reproducible. It's definitely there. What I would suggest is if you confirm this is happening on your device, that you go to apple.com/feedback and you just put in, hey, Apple, you know, this crash is happening in the Photos app. And that's what Greg and I did. The more people they get reporting it, the more likely it is to get patched. Now, it could already be slated in the 8.1.1 patch we mentioned earlier, and hopefully it is. But you know, that little bug was there, and I found it interesting, and it certainly is repeatable. So I wanted to mention that to you in case you are wondering the same thing. Why is my Photos app crashing from time to time? Now, unrelated, but something I also wanted to mention is if you have been seeing other types of crashes and crashes in other areas, specifically what I call the springboard crash, where you're, you know, humming along, you're working on your iOS device, and then suddenly everything goes black and you just see the Apple logo. I've been getting a lot of those. And what I noticed was that it seemed to be not a like full reboot. What was happening was I was seeing the Apple logo come up. It was only a few seconds and then I was right back into being able to access my device. So it was almost like sort of this kind of soft crash or something like that. I was getting a lot of those and they seemed to be happening more and more frequently for me. I was able to do a hard reboot of my iPhone. So hold down the sleep wake button and the home button for a few seconds until you see the Apple logo, let it reboot all the way. And that process takes quite a bit longer than just the, you know, white Apple logo crash reboot that I was seeing. And after I did that, it seemed to dramatically reduce the number of sort of soft white Apple logo crashes I was seeing, for lack of a better thing to sort of call them. So you might give that a try if you've been having issues. And then once again, I think if I continue to see those kinds of crashes, I will do a backup and software restore in iTunes of my iOS device and see if I can't clear those things up. But little iOS crash troubleshooting tips for you to start off the feedback portion of the MacCast. Next up, I have a report from you about a different kind of hardware crash on the iPhone 6. This one being a little bit more physical, and it came in via an audio comment from listener Graham.
Hello, Adam. This is Graham from Raleigh, North Carolina. I wanted to give your listeners a heads up on a vulnerability in the new iPhone 6 display glass so that they can avoid some of the problems that I've had. One of the great features of the new iPhone 6 glass is that it has rounded edges that flow over the top of the phone and extend down the side a wee bit. It looks great because it really makes the display stand out. But for those of us who are a bit clumsy, like me, there's a real downside to this design. Last week, I was putting my iPhone in a holster case that's clipped to my belt. Unfortunately, I missed the holster and the phone fell on the ground. Now, my phone is enclosed in a case, but the case that I purchased has an open bottom, and that allows for easy connection of the earbuds and the power cord. My phone hit the ground right on the bottom edge, and the glass shattered. Now, I promptly went to the Apple Store and had a great experience there. I quickly got the glass replaced for just over $100, and they did the repair right there in the store. However, 2 days later, I did the exact same thing again. I dropped the phone on the bottom edge, and the glass shattered one more time. So what's going on here? Well, it turns out that the glass that curves over the edge of the new iPhone 6 makes it especially vulnerable to breakage. In past designs of the phone, the glass edge has always been completely enclosed in metal. If you drop the phone on the edge, the metal was a lot more likely to take the blow. That metal was a bit more forgiving. It would bend a bit, but probably would leave the glass unbroken. With the new iPhone 6 design, that's not the case. If you drop the phone and it hits on the front edge, the glass alone takes the full force of the fall. This is the reason my iPhone 6 was a double casualty of my clumsiness. So here's some important advice from a two-time loser like me. Make sure that the case you buy covers all the edges of your phone. My case covered most of the phone, but left the bottom edge open to allow easy access to the mics and cords. Because I used a belt clip case, that means I miss the holster and the phone drops directly on its most vulnerable spot. This is a great phone, but it's much more susceptible to glass breakage, and you need to buy a case that will protect all the edges. Thank you for the show, Adam. I've been a listener since the beginning, and it's an amazing resource for all of us in the Mac community. Thanks again.
Hey, thanks, Graham. I appreciate the comment and a little bit of warning. I guess, you know, for those of us who are maybe a little bit clumsier with our devices, we should probably consider about that bottom edge or just the edge in general, especially since that glass does kind of wrap over in that way. I have the Apple leather case, which wraps all of the edges nicely, except, again, that bottom edge. Now, I'm typically trying to remember how I insert my phone into my, because I like to keep mine in my front left pocket. I think I typically put it in with that port side down, so I could potentially be susceptible to the same style of damage. So I guess if you're that type of person, you maybe want to look for a more of a bumper style case that wraps the edge all the way around. Of course, you lose the convenience of that access to those ports. I know many people swear by, especially those who are a little bit clumsier, swear by either something like an OtterBox or a LifeProof rugged case. I mean, those things you can basically, you know, drop a bomb on your iPhone and it's probably going to be safe. I know that's being a bit extreme, but I mean, those things really do, you know, take a beating and the phone survives inside. Really amazing stuff. So if you are that type of person, maybe spend the little extra cash for that sort of protection. The biggest thing about your comment that I wanted to sort of bring up was it really made me question the value of AppleCare Plus. I had not been the type of person who would typically get AppleCare for my iOS devices until I had a couple incidents where, you know, I screwed up and I made a mistake and I damaged my devices. Specifically, you may remember if you've listened for a long time, and it sounds like you have, that I left my iPhone and iPad on top of my car one time. And had to pay, you know, some out-of-warranty replacement costs, which were a little bit pricey. And most recently, I took my iPhone 5S swimming. And luckily with that one, I did have the AppleCare Plus, so I just had to pay the per-incident charge, which was $79, to get a replacement. Now, I know that what we're talking about here is specifically glass, but you noted in your comment that the glass replacement without the AppleCare Plus, I'm assuming, cost you just over $100. And I went and looked at Apple's site, and sure enough, an iPhone 6 replacement glass installed by Apple at the retail store is $109 for the iPhone 6 Plus, for iPhone 6. If you have an iPhone 6 Plus, iPhone 5S, or 5C, or an iPhone 5, the replacement glass is $129. So you start doing the math and you look at, well, AppleCare Plus, it's $79 per incident for that damage, and you pay $99 up front for AppleCare. So in my mind, that means each incident really costs you $79 plus $49, so for a total of $128 per incident. I recognize I'm ignoring the extra year of AppleCare coverage that you get with AppleCare Plus that would cover, you know, any failed components. Out of the box, you get 1 year, you know, everybody gets 1 year of coverage on AppleCare just by buying the device. AppleCare Plus adds another year to that, plus the accidental damage. But the main reason I'm buying AppleCare Plus at this point is for the lower cost if I do have accidental damage. And the most common, I think, accidental damage with an iPhone is going to be replacing the screen. So I may, in the future, really start to question that. Apple has been slowly increasing that per incident charge. I think it used to be $49. It's now $79. And if replacing the glass is only $109 or $129, I'm not so sure the value is there for those of us who are just buying it for the accidental coverage and not for other reasons. Be curious to get any of your thoughts on that. If you want to send feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Are you the type of person that gets AppleCare Plus on your iPhone or not? I think I may continue to get it with the iPads, although I'll probably be investigating the replacement costs for glass and things like that there as well. If the pricing falls in the same range, I may opt in the future not to get AppleCare Plus on even those devices. It's an interesting thing to think about, and your audio comment, Graham, certainly prompted me to look into it a little bit deeper, so thank you for that. Lastly, before we get to our interview, I want to comment on an email that I had with listener Hugh. We'd actually been going back and forth on an issue that he was having unrelated to this, but he mentioned after we had gone back and forth a few times that he had a different issue with his new iPhone 6 Plus and taking photos. Specifically, he had been on a trip and he was taking all of his pictures in the camera app with the black and white filter applied. And if you use the camera app and you've used the filters, you know that now in iOS 8, and I can't remember when they added this, but those filters are applied live in real time. So you can go into the camera app, you can click on the little filter button, the little thing that looks like the three overlapping circles, and you can pick different sorts of effects and filters. And then any photo that you take will have that filter applied to it. So Hugh was using the black and white filter, and they show up that way in the camera roll as black and white. If you open them up in other apps or use any of the sharing options in iOS and share them, they're also shared as black and white. So if you send them as a tweet or an email or post them to Facebook, they show up as black and white. But what was odd was that Hugh noted when he got back from his vacation and connected his iPhone to his Mac using the USB cable and transferred the photos into iPhoto, they did not have the black and white effect applied to them. They were all in color, basically the raw images before the filter had been applied. And he had taken a ton of these black and white photos and wanted to know, how do I get all these onto my Mac as black and white? And I thought this was odd as well, and I even confirmed this on my iPhone. Any filters that you apply in the camera app don't seem to transfer when you sync your device. And it gets a little bit worse because I thought, well, maybe if I go through my photo stream, those that show up automatically in iPhoto and photo stream, maybe those will have the effect applied. Sure enough, no, they didn't either. So what is going on here? And this actually goes also for any edits that you might make in the Photos app. I noticed if I made edits on my iPhone in the camera app, those edits were visible and viewable on the iPhone and also were applied when I did any of the sharing options. But when I got back to iPhoto, once again, all I had was the raw photos without any edits. So I was looking into this, trying to figure out how can you get around this. It seemed like the only way would be to use one of the sharing options on your iPhone to actually get it into another app or to share it over via email. So email them to yourself to get the versions with the effects applied. I also confirmed that I could go into an app on my iOS device like Dropbox and actually upload them to my Dropbox and then go into Dropbox on my Mac and manually add them to iPhoto that way. If I did that, the effects were maintained. And I'm pretty sure I understand the reason why this happens. On your iOS device, when you apply filters and effects and do any edits, all of that information is now stored just as metadata that's attached to the file. So that's how Apple's able to maintain the original file. And basically all of those edits are applied in real time on your iOS device. Or I think when you go to share it, it uses that metadata, applies all of those effects, and then sends out the edited version, basically making a copy of it. But I noted that even when I went into my photo stream and chose to edit a file, and it even gives you the little dialogue that says, hey, this is a photo stream file. Do you want to duplicate and apply your edits to the duplicate photo? It duplicates it, allows you to apply the edits on your iOS device, apply any filters and things like that. But once again, when you sync it back to your Mac, you don't get the edited versions of the photos. So I don't know if this is going to change. Apple is going to be releasing a Photos app for the Mac that eventually is going to replace iPhoto and Aperture. Hopefully it'll have the ability to read that sort of sidecar metadata file and actually show you the version on your Mac with the edits applied. But it seems like with iPhoto currently, it's not doing that. And I don't see any easy way to actually get those reapplied to your photos once you've synced them over to your Mac, other than having to go through some sort of convoluted process of sending it from your iOS device to another app and then bringing it back into iPhoto. There doesn't seem to be a direct way to do it. And I guess what both Hugh and I are wondering is there something we're missing here? Is there a way to sync your photos back from your iOS device to your Mac and get it with the version, get the versions of those photos with any effects and edits already applied to them? If you happen to know, if you know a trick, or maybe even there's a third-party app for that, please share it with us. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com, and I'll watch for that. And if I hear of anything, Hugh, I'll be sure to share it on a future episode. So now I want to get to the interview that I told you about at the top of the show. I really do get asked quite frequently, hey, I think I want to go into iOS development. How do I even get started with this? What is it like to be an iOS developer? How do you make money? Do you make apps? Are there other ways to do it? Do you have to make your own app? Lots of questions start to come up surrounding this. And I think part of the issue is mostly what we hear about are the big successful developers and publishing companies and titles, you know, like the Zyngas and the Rovios of the world. We hear a lot about them and sort of their process and how they had a breakout hit app. But, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of apps on the App Store. How do those things get there? Now, how do apps get created? And, you know, most of them aren't created by these big publishing houses and these big successful companies. A lot of it is the little guy, the garage developer. And what is it like to be that sort of developer? And I'm in the lucky position that I run the iOS San Diego iOS meetup group, and I sit down with a bunch of these guys who are in the trenches building apps either for themselves or for other people every day. And I wanted to get a couple of them on to talk to them about that whole process. So I invited my friends from Diddy Labs, Carson Whitsett and Adam Harris. They founded the company a few years ago, and I just sat them down and we talked about, hey, how did you get into this stuff? And what are some of the projects and things that you're working on? They actually have an update for a game they've been working on coming out that I think you're really going to like. So you'll hear about that in this interview. But here's my interview with Diddy Labs.
All right. So I'm here with Carson Whitsett and Adam Harris. They are the co-founders of Diddy Labs, which is an iOS development company. And I wanted to get these guys on the MacCast because, well, one, I know them both from my iOS group here in San Diego, but also because they've done something that many of you have asked me about from time to time. And that is they moved and transitioned from a day job to doing iOS development. And so I guess I'll start with maybe you, Adam. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, that process or that decision? I mean, what made you decide to, and it's been a few years now, but what made you decide to kind of jump into iOS development and kind of make that leap?
Well, I had been doing software development since basically college, so many, many years now. But in my latest job before this one, I started to work my way out of actually doing the development, and I was doing more and more management. And in the end, I was doing no development at all, and I started to miss it, ultimately. And so I thought there has to be some way I can get back into the game, get back in there and actually do some programming. And I talked to Carson, and Carson pretty much felt the same way.
So was that kind of the case for you, too? Was it the same kind of thing, or was it a little bit different?
For me, I like to show people what I'm working on. And I was working at a company where we were doing kind of military contracts. And you can't really show someone some top secret thing that you're working on. So there was a little bit of anxiety building up. And, you know, one day Adam and I were instant messaging back and forth. And we decided, you know, why don't we make iPhone apps? And that's kind of how it started, you know, that kind of planted the seed of, you know, let's leave our safe day job and take the plunge and start our own company.
Was timing part of it too? I mean, you guys were kind of on the earlier edge of, you know, iOS development. I think it was maybe a little bit scarier when you started, don't you think?
I don't know. It's funny you say that, because in a way, I think we thought we were a little behind the ball. I mean, it was 2009 that we started talking about it, and it seemed like, oh, geez, we're getting in late. And looking back on it now, no, we were getting in early. But I think if anything, we thought, oh, we've got some catching up to do. There are people that have been doing apps for a year or so now. So that was part of it.
Right. And one thing that I wanted to talk to you guys about, because I kind of see, you know, development, I guess building the company is a little bit where I want to start, maybe, is... another question I get from a lot of folks is, you know, do I start on my own? Do I get a partner? You guys obviously had each other right from the get-go. Do you think, you know, it matters? Was that a difference? And maybe talk to sort of what each of you do within Diddy Labs right now. I'll start with you, Carson.
I really like having a partnership, because some of my skills are different than Adam's skills, and we really complement each other. Adam's real good at kind of structuring the code and building a foundation. And then I'll do a lot of graphic stuff and animation. And together we can put together a really nice app. So I think having multiple people with multiple different skill sets really makes it easier to put an app together.
Do you kind of agree with that?
Yeah, I think if you find the right partner, the trick is knowing whether you're going to be able to work well together. And so Carson and I, a number of years before we even started this, had worked together at a company doing video games on the Sega Saturn and the Sony PlayStation. So we knew we could work well together. But knowing that, yeah, I mean, it is so much better having a partner to fall back on. I mean, from one standpoint, it's a matter of one person's burnout or hitting a wall or having a problem, the other guy steps up and goes, let me take that. I'll write that client email, or I'll give them a call, or I'll take care of it. And it's like, oh, thank God. I think it would be a lot more difficult doing this on our own.
Right. Another thing that comes up quite frequently, I think, too, and I'd be curious to get your guys' take on this, is, you know, I think when you're starting a company, you don't think of, and this was true even for me when I started the podcast thing, that, oh, I'm going to make a podcast and it's just going to be this audio thing and I've got to record some stuff and post it online. I think with apps, a lot of guys start out too thinking, oh, I just got to program an app and put it in the app store, and then away you go. But there's business sides to this sort of stuff, and there's marketing, and there's art. And we kind of talk about this too in our iOS group, right? This idea, what do they call it? I've talked about it on the podcast before, iCam, that Jeff throws out there. So it's, you know, it's not just the programming, it's the ideas, it's the marketing, it's the art, and it's the programming, it's all that stuff together. So how do you guys handle that sort of stuff? Or, you know, can you talk about maybe some of the challenges or how that goes about within the company?
Well, a lot of it's learning as we go. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's more than development for us. And I think it ends up being that we're all the departments in our own company, our own HR, our own legal, our own marketing, our own business side. And some of that sometimes is a struggle for us to try to fit it in with development. I think, at least for me, I won't speak for Carson, but for me, I think it's more about how am I going to fit all that other parts of the company work in while I'm trying to concentrate on developing an application. And I think we've kind of learned some mechanisms to help cope with that, and a lot of making mistakes and then fixing them and keeping track of what we've done.
Yeah, so what do you think about that? Do you guys end up having to outsource stuff?
We do. I'm pretty good at programmer art. I've gotten pretty skilled at Photoshop, and there's a lot of things that we can do that actually ends up looking pretty nice. But it is a relief when we find an artist to help us out. And then the whole marketing side, we're still trying to figure that out. That's a big challenge.
Right. Well, and so then another thing that I wanted to ask you guys about. So when you started, and I've talked to people about what I kind of see as two paths of app development. We mentioned this. I mentioned this to you guys a little bit earlier, where, you know, some guys are going into it and they've got an app idea and they're like, I'm going to make this app and that's going to be the thing that I'm going to build and I'm going to throw it in the app store and that's how I'm going to make my money. And then there's kind of the other path that I'm finding a lot of developers take, where maybe they started out that way, or maybe they just, you know, had somebody who came to them knowing they're a programmer and said, hey, I have this app idea. Can you build this app for me? So when you guys started the company, was it to sort of launch your own app or go more into the contract work stuff? And where does the company kind of sit now?
Well, I think we always wanted to do our own applications because for us, that's the most creatively fulfilling. But at the same time, you know, Carson and I both had families we had to take care of. We're leaving our job. We're going to do this full time. And so we had to be, you know, careful about being able to make some long-term investment on a single app that's going to, you know, hopefully hit it big, or when we play the app lotto, as I like to call it. So I think we knew right away we were going to have to pick up contracts. And the idea was to do contracts for other companies to get paid as we do our work. And then in between contracts, or even part-time, if the contracts are part-time, we work on our own stuff.
Right. And I know, Carson, you have a few apps that I think we're going to get into and sort of talk about that are in the App Store, but you're obviously also doing the contract work. So is it kind of the same thing for you?
Yep. It's a big struggle because you always want to finish what you're working on, your own app, but you got to work on the contracts to pay the bills and keep the lights on. So, it's oftentimes a slow process, and you have to have a lot of patience to get your own stuff out there.
Right. What do you guys think about the balance of that sort of thing, too? I mean, I would imagine that's a huge challenge, right? Because you do want to work creatively on your sorts of things. But like you said, you got to get the bills paid. So, you know, how do you guys manage that or deal with that?
I think the biggest challenge for me on that is being able to do a lot of things means I'm having to task switch. And for me, when I'm programming, I like to really get into what I'm working on. And so the biggest issue I have is being pulled from whatever I'm developing, even if it's for a client, to handle some, you know, internal marketing or HR or whatever issue we have to deal with, and it's pulling me away from that. And that task switching has a cost, because getting back into that world of the thing that you're working on takes a little while. So there's like some inertia you have to overcome to get back into it.
Right. It's that what I call interrupt-driven workflows are very, very challenging. So, you know, for you, Carson, right, I would imagine them very often, because you have your own stuff, you're like, I want to get back to my own stuff. You know, how do you make that work or find the time, those sorts of things?
A lot of times I can justify it. I'll take the time. I'll work extra hard and I'll take the time to develop something that I know we can use in a client project. Because then we're learning about some new technology that's offered, you know, a new version of iOS comes out with lots of new features, and we can apply that to our own stuff. And now we have that knowledge, and now we can share that with client projects as well.
All right. So now I do want to get into some of your own apps and just the general challenges of developing an app and working with the App Store and marketing and stuff like that. So we can get to that side of it. But before we kind of finish up this, you know, starting a company and kind of getting into app development, I want to ask each of you, you know, what is maybe one thing that you've learned along the way, or a bit of advice if someone is like on the fence about, I've got this day job, but I kind of want to go do this thing. You know, what would you say to them?
For me, it's passion. If you're passionate about an idea, the product you make is going to be a lot better than if you're just ho-hum about it. So I think if you're really passionate about it and you know what's out there, you don't necessarily have to be the first out there, but if you're the best, then people recognize that.
What about you, Adam?
I would say try not to have your expectations too high. You know, just know that you're getting into it because you're enjoying the work. And if you can stay on that, if you can just stay on, I'm enjoying what I'm doing, and not try to think too far on whether it's going to be successful or it is successful, then you won't drive yourself crazy.
Yeah, I think that's kind of good advice. You know, when I jumped into the podcasting thing, it was the same kind of thing. I think I did, in some ways, set some high expectations, and I ended up originally kind of going back to work for a little bit because it got scary. But when you're able to kind of let that go and just go, yeah, I'm going to follow my passion on this, I'm just going to do what I love, I don't know what happens, but something kind of magical almost happens where people realize and feel that in you, and then stuff just starts to roll naturally. I don't know. Did you guys have an experience sort of like that?
Yeah, I think we found that with our clients. I think when we meet with them and we talk with them, we do get this feeling of feedback from them that, wow, these guys are really sincere about what they do and honest, and we can trust them, which is a really good feeling, because in the end, that's we want to make them happy with whatever's going on. And I think that makes them feel comfortable, like, I can pick up the phone and call them if it's any kind of an issue. So along those lines, we try to stay real responsive, because it's about building that relationship ultimately.
Did you have something to add to that? No.
No, Adam covered it.
Okay. Well, that's good, because I do want to get into the app stuff. So do you want to tell people about Topword and kind of the current project that you're working on, the game that you're building for iOS? And I guess you've been working on it for a while, but you've got some new stuff going on with it now, right?
Yeah. So we originally released Topword on the App Store in November of 2013. So it's been out almost a year. And there's always been some more stuff that I wanted to add to it. And of course, we've gotten really busy with client projects. So recently we have found the time, or we made the time, to add all these extra features. One of them being, compatibility with the iPad, which originally it was an iPhone only app. And we were finding that customers that had an iPad would search for it on the store and not find it because it's only in the iPhone section of the store. So that's one of the main features. Adam can talk about maybe some other things we're doing.
Sure. Well, let's maybe back up a little bit, though, and just let folks know what is Top Word?
Top Word is a word search game. There's several games out there like it. It's basically a 4x4 grid of letters, and you have a time limit, and you have to see how many words you can find in the given amount of time. But then we took it another level past all the other games that I've seen out there, where when you find words, it adds time to the timer. So you can kind of keep the game going longer by finding more words.
By successfully searching words and stuff like that. And I think I told you the first time I saw it, it felt a little like a Boggle-style game for people who are trying to just wrap their head around, you know, what it's like.
Yeah, but unlike Boggle, there's, you know, we have this kind of electronic medium where we can do a lot more than you could with the physical game. So, you know, we reward the player with cool guitar licks and explosions and all kinds of little bonus things that you normally wouldn't get. Plus, you know, on a physical game like that, you're kind of at the whim of what the letters come up with on the dice. We can kind of fine tune that and generate puzzles that are challenging and have a good number of solutions in them. And, you know, so there's a lot of extra stuff we can do.
Right. And I think, like you said, there's a lot of these style games out there. So I'll throw this back to Adam and ask you, you know, about the challenges, I think, of developing games. I mean, you guys picked a hard category, I think, right, going into?
Well, I think first and foremost, it has to be something you're really interested in always, because that's what's going to drive you through to add new, neat bells and whistles and things. And I know Carson, you know, wanted to move this forward, and I was on board with it because he was really interested in this kind of a game. So the trick, I think, with competing is just try to add more and more and more fun. You know, if you're into the game yourself, you're already saying, what else can I put in here that would make this fun for me?
So my whole inspiration for starting this game was I was playing another game like it, and I would play it every night before I went to bed. I'd get as far as I could get, the timer would run out, and I'd always feel like I'm missing something. The time runs out, and that's it, game over. So that one of the first things I did was say, well, if you get a word, it adds more time. But then I'm like, well, what if you get the top word, you know, because there's the top word is the longest, most difficult word in the puzzle. I would get that in this other game and nothing would happen. And I'm like, oh, I want to be rewarded for something like that. So that's when I came up with the explosion and the guitar sounds. And then it just kept building from there. So yeah, just keep adding stuff that's fun. And as you play, ideas come to you and you write them down so that when you get time to work on them, you can look at your list of ideas and go, oh, I'm going to code that up today.
It's interesting because I'm hearing you talk about that, and something I hear quite a lot from developers, and maybe you guys can you know, sort of confirm this, but I think it's almost become a truth, is often you build the thing that you want for yourself, right? And that tends to lead to something that's maybe a little more successful.
Yeah, definitely. And your close friends and family, too. You know, the ones that are getting into it, they'll say, you know, oh, it'd be really cool if you did this. So you take those into account. But yeah, an example of something that we added to it, or is coming out in this newest release that's due out, is the ability for you to have sound packs. So as you trace a word, there'll be some sound effect associated with the word that you're getting. You know, things like that, or being able to record your own sounds, you know, is something that other people were saying, that would be great.
Right. So I guess the other aspect of that, though, too, is I would imagine you guys also get tons of ideas, and this probably happens in all your projects. Your clients come to you with a bunch of ideas. You have your own ideas and things like that, or people say things. How do you decide what not to do?
So I I do get a lot of ideas and write them down in a list. We actually have them written down in the source code, and that way we can share them and both see them. And then we prioritize them. I think I was putting little asterisks next to the ones that I thought we should have out for this release. And then once they're prioritized, Adam and I will just pick which one sounds like fun to work on and to take it.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you started with just being an iPhone app, and I'm not sure, you know, at what version you started it with. But I also wanted to get into, the device ecosystem, and I think you alluded to this with the iPad thing, is, you know, constantly changing and metamorphosizing and things like that. So can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges? Like, how do you decide, okay, it's going to be this device only, or we're going to do it on all these devices, things like that? What kind of thought process goes into that decision?
I think these days you have to make it work on every device, and that's just the bottom line. It has to work on everything.
Yeah. What about the challenges of that for like development?
Well, I'll modify that a little bit, because it depends on if you're talking about our own internal apps or ones for clients. For the clients, oftentimes they know exactly what they want to target. And if they know they want to target just the phone, they'll say, I don't want anything to do with the iPad. Or sometimes they'll say, no, this is an iPad app. So in those cases, we let them drive it unless they have questions. It does take a lot more effort to do it on multiple devices, because I think what you're just asking is, well, you know, what is that going to take? And there's a huge jump in effort when you're going for something that will run both on the iPhone and the iPad, sometimes as much as another 50%, because every screen you design on the iPhone, you need to come up with an equivalent screen on the iPad. Even if it's exactly the same, you still have to code that up.
You had something to add to that?
And sometimes the screens aren't laid out exactly the same. Right. The iPhone, you know, the easiest way is to just scale up the iPhone to fill the iPad screen, but that is not necessarily the most aesthetically pleasing screen. And a lot of times with the extra screen real estate on the iPad, you have more space to put extra stuff that you wouldn't see on the iPhone. So you have to think about that when you're coding for the iPad.
Yeah. Let's talk just real briefly. What I'm curious about now is, you've had this app in the App Store. You're putting out a new version. How do you guys deal with marketing and just like getting discovered and like finding your place in the app? You know, like, how, I think this is another universal for a lot of app developers. Like, how do I get my app out there? How do I get people to know about it?
That's a really good question. I think we're probably better at answering the development questions. Right. But, I think that we've tried to hit all the marks that everyone has said or you see out there, which is the social media, you know, try to do a little bit of advertising, hopefully get some word of mouth. You kind of just run the whole, get some press releases out there, send the press releases early before the app's going to come out to all the reviewers, all those types of things. In the end, you don't know what's going to hit. And so can be very frustrating, because you're doing all this work and you don't know what's going to become of it. It's very different from development, which I think makes it frustrating for us sometimes, because with development, I know if I put in a certain amount of effort, I'm going to get this cool thing happening on the screen. When it comes to marketing and sales and those types of things, it's, I don't know if anything's really going to happen when I do this.
You could spend a lot of money on advertising and get nothing back. Right. So it's you really have to think about where you're spending your marketing time and marketing money.
Have you guys not found, have you found any kinds of things that seem to work better for you than others? Things that maybe you tried and you would avoid?
The only thing I can say is that it's really important to get people, if you're really confident in your product, to get it in their hands as easily as you can. And so I think the thing we've come to understand, maybe a little bit too late, is you got to make it free. And then if you're going to try to get some kind of revenue outside of that freeness, you have to put some things in there that you can have the users buy and then contribute to your ongoing development, because you can't do it for free forever.
You know, that's interesting, because listeners to my show will know that I am not a fan. I am probably the biggest person opposing the whole freemium model, but I fully recognize that's sort of where the market is taking things. I mean, so it sounds like you guys see that as being the future.
Well, it's kind of like how shareware used to be, where you could download the product for free, but it was limited in some way, and then you can pay the shareware fee, and it would unlock extra features, and, you know, it just gives the user the ability to try out the software and decide that, hey, I like the quality of this, you know, I'm willing to pay for the extra stuff. So, you know, that's one of the things we changed this go around is we made the app free. And we put all kinds of in-app purchases, and they're all fun little add-ons, you know, the sound packs and the word run meter and just fun stuff that hopefully people will like and want to try out.
Right. So that kind of gives you gives the audience, I think, a way to reward the developer, but they're actually able to get in at a little lower barrier, I guess.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I don't quite understand the psychology of people who look at the apps, and as soon as they see a price, even for a dollar, they're taken away from it. Like, oh, I don't know, a dollar, you know, when they'll spend a dollar and a meter for 15 minutes. But I think I have a theory on why that is, and I think it has to do with commitment to what they're downloading. I think as soon as they pay money, it isn't the fact that they're actually paying money. It's that when they pay for an app, they feel like they're obliged to use and enjoy that app. And so I think there's some kind of a psychological block that says, ooh, if I pay for it, I'm committed to this thing. I'm really going to use it. And I don't know if I can fit it in with everything else I have going on, as strange as that may sound. And so I think the idea is you make it free so people don't feel committed, and then they feel more comfortable and less stressed about getting in. Oh, I'll just download it, and when I get to it, I get to it. And I think it must be more that than it is the dollar, because right. People can't really consider a dollar to be that expensive. It's got to be something else.
What are your guys' thoughts on the ad-supported model maybe versus the in-app purchase model?
I hate ads.
I loathe ads. I really do. It takes away from the aesthetics of everything you're trying to present. I mean, to me, it breaks, you know, I've got a little bit of a theater background, and so I think it breaks the aesthetic distance between you and the app. The app is trying to take you somewhere and put you in a completely different space, and an ad is doing exactly the opposite. It's dragging you right back into a completely different place.
Now, the other thing I'm curious about, and maybe you guys have never done an app with ads, you know, just based on that response, but maybe even if you know from other developers and things like that, it just seems like to me that the actual revenue generated from in ad stuff probably isn't that high, or maybe I'm just misguided on that. I don't know. Do you guys happen to know?
So we have done apps with ads. And our clients have not shared how well those ads have done, so we don't know.
Well, that just sort of almost says the answer right there, right? If people aren't talking about it, it's probably not doing all that well. Unless you have a huge title that's got, you know, millions, billions of downloads.
Right. I think that's absolutely what it comes down to. If you're an extremely successful app, then ads are going to do great for you, right? And if you're not, then they're going to give you just little to nothing. So you got to get in front of people regardless of whether you have ads or not. And you're going to do really well if it's big, and you're not going to do so well if it's not, either way.
So I guess bringing it back to maybe Topword just to finish things up, you mentioned that it is free, and with this new version you have in-app purchases. What kinds of things are we talking about? You know, are these add-ons, or these, you know, what are you getting for that extra money?
I'll talk some about that. So yeah, I think the most important thing to note is that we haven't made anything that was already available in the previous version costly now. You get everything that you got before. So in the update, we have all of the things that were in the game before, and then a few little extras as well. On top of that, Carson can kind of go through some of the aspects, but of some of those. Go ahead and share some of those.
So we have a 10-second game, and this was kind of interesting because during development, we were writing code for stuff that happened after the game was over, and we didn't want to wait a minute for the game to end, so we hacked the code to make the game finish in 10 seconds. Well, while I'm waiting for the game to finish in 10 seconds, I start playing it, and it's actually kind of fun. So how many words can you get? You know, because every time you get a word, it adds time. So, you know, I'm making a 10-second game last over a minute because I keep finding words, and that was fun enough for us to decide to make that an in-app purchase. We also have a timeless game, which you turn the timer off completely. We've had several requests for this, and I find that my 6-year-old son, he's in first grade right now, and he's learning spelling. He loves the timeless game, and he'll sit there. He wants to borrow my phone in the morning before he goes to school and at night before he goes to bed, and he wants to play Top Word. And the other day, I heard him actually sounding out. He was going, quest. And he did it, and the word came up, and I was blown away. That's a six-year-old sounding out the word Quest. So that's a fun in-app purchase. We also have a Foundum, which is when you get really good at the game, you're pretty far along through the puzzle, and you're not quite sure if you found all the three-letter words or all the four-letter words. So this in-app purchase will actually give you an indicator that says, hey, you found all the three-letter words, so that way you don't have to worry about trying to find more three-letter words, and you can focus your attention on finding the longer ones.
Yeah, so it sounds like a lot of it is really changing the game dynamics, the game mechanics in various ways, and then it looks like, you know, I think we talked about sound effects and those sorts of things. So, you know, basically using in-app purchase as a way to kind of expand and enhance sort of the core game. It seems like that's the concept here.
Yeah, I think the idea behind freemium in general is to go after the people who really enjoy the game and want to be able to buy new stuff for it. You know, it would be like someone who has a car that they really like and they want to buff it out more, get new rims or new whatever. So you want to get those people who are way into the game and would love to do cool, fun add-on stuff.
Cool, do more stuff, yeah. And it's almost like expansion packs. I'm really into board games, and you get board game expansions and things like that, right? So you get the base game, and now you've got all kinds of additional enhancements and things you can throw on top of there. That's pretty cool. I think this is probably a good point to kind of wrap things up. But I want to thank you both for kind of coming on and talking about Top Word. Now, new version's coming out, so let everybody know sort of, you know, when is it out yet, or is it on its way out?
The current version is out, and you can download it now. The new version comes out on November 13th.
All right, so people can go get that. It's obviously free. The game is called Top Word. From
Diddy Labs.
Okay, it is under Diddy Labs. They never know because, you know, the way the App Store works and things like that. So, Carson, I guess outside this, if people want to follow, you know, Diddy Labs and what you guys are up to, is there a website they can go to, stuff they can check out?
Yeah, we have diddylabs.com, and then we have topwordapp.com as well, just for the game, and then we have a Facebook for both Diddy Labs and for Top Word, and Twitter for both of those as well.
All right, awesome. Thanks, Carson.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Adam.
So there you go, the guys from Diddy Labs. Make sure you check out the game Top Word. You can get it now. Hopefully, by the time you hear this, the update is out and available. You never really know when with Apple. They, you know, as a developer, you kind of have to submit this thing, and hopefully, they release it on the day that you want. But if it comes back with app review issues, anything like that, like we kind of talked about in the segment there, then it may be delayed a little bit. But the game is available. You can also check out topwordapp.com. And I also wanted to mention something that didn't come up in the interview. For those of you out there who are Mac historians, you may or may not have recognized Carson's name from a popular game on the Mac back in the day called Mac Brickout. He was the developer of that application, and a few years back, he actually brought it back out for iOS. So if you want to get some good, updated, retro gaming fun on the iPad or iPhone in the form of a breakout game, you can get Mac Brickout for iOS. You can find it on the App Store, or you can just check out macbrickout.com. And again, thanks to both the guys for coming on the show and talking to us. Finally today, I actually have one more quick tip for you. I think I covered this at one point, but it came up last week via an email, and it's specifically related to OS X Yosemite. In the upgrade, Apple changed the functionality of the little green stoplight buttons in your window. So that's the little red, yellow, and green button that appear at the top left of your windows. And always in the past, the green button would allow you to maximize the window on your desktop, but in Yosemite, now the default behavior has been changed, and when you click on it, it puts your application or your window into full screen mode. Luckily, you can get the maximize functionality back fairly easily by holding down the Option key before you click on the little green stoplight button, and you'll even notice when you hold down the Option key and hover over it, instead of seeing the full screen, you know, double arrow icon, you will see the familiar little plus maximize icon. So that's how you get that functionality back. Unfortunately, I don't think there's a way to change the default behavior back to the old behavior. I'd prefer to have the maximize and then have to use the Option key to do the full screen mode because I use Maximize much more frequently, but I've just gotten in the habit of holding down that option key every time I click on that little green stoplight button. So hopefully that'll help some of you out in case you were wondering what exactly happened there and didn't know that you could still get the old behavior back. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, hey, if you want to get some cash for your new iPhone 6, you can sell your old iPhone on Gazelle. It's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadget. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. And lynda.com, they help keep you up to date with your software, pick up new brand new skills, and explore new hobbies. With their easy-to-follow video tutorials, you can get a free trial simply by going to lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, you have a comment, a question, or a topic you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can always send me email. My email address is maccast@gmail.com. If you'd prefer to leave a voicemail message, you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9 is the phone number. You can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's over at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can also follow me online between shows. I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. And we also have a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. And I look forward to seeing you online between shows. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.